Honorable Chair, could we be quiet, please, colleagues?
Yes, afternoon, MTPP and to your team.
Thank you, Chair.
You have been detained for the whole day today. Our apologies, we thought that the department would be done at least by 11:30.
We were hoping so too, Chair.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Our apologies, but I think you had an opportunity to listen to them to understand also their challenges. And thank you very much. Is Advocate Anton Duplessis part of the team?
Yes, he is, Chair.
Then Advocate Baloyi, Lebogang Dineo Baloyi.
No. Lebo? No. Is that Lebo? Yes, Chair.
Okay. Advocate Gamo.
Ohatla.
And then Advocate Prayer Biswar. Is it Biswar?
The Seswar, yes, that's correct.
Are they part of the team?
Yes, that's correct, Chair.
Okay. No, we would like to start by welcoming them and congratulating them on the appointment by the president as the NDPP and special directors, respectively. You are welcome to the portfolio committee, and we congratulate you on appointment. We hope to be working very well with you to carry out the mandate of ensuring that South Africans are safe and the NPA represent the state in court very well with your assistance. Thank you very much and you are welcome. NTPP, if you can start by...
Chair, before we move off the point of your congratulations, Chair, there was another special director who was appointed, Advocate Bonnie Kari Gamwa, as the special director of the Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit. So there are three very competent women that have been appointed as special directors. You mentioned Lebo and Priya, but Bonnie is the third one.
I did just, I said Advocate Gamwa, but maybe I was
wrong. Oh, yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. No, you are all welcome and congratulations on your appointment. NTPP, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. So good afternoon to you again, Chair, and good afternoon to honorable members. In addition to colleagues that the Chair has just congratulated on their appointments, I am joined today by the four Deputy National Directors of Public Prosecutions, and I'm very pleased that it's the first time we present an APP with a full house of DNDPPs. And so it's Advocate Rodney de Kock, the head of the National Prosecution Service, Advocate Nomvula Mohatla, who is the head of the Legal Advisory Division, Advocate Omar Rabaji Rasataba, who is the head of the Asset Forfeiture Unit, and Advocate Anton Duplessis, who you mentioned, who heads up the Strategy Operations and Compliance portfolio at the NPA. In addition, Advocate Mtunzi Mahaga is present, my special director, and we have other colleagues, Advocate Karen van Rensburg, Ms. Sidi Modise, who is the head of HR, Ms. Bulelwa Makeke, who is our head of communications, Ms. Salome Baloyi, who is the acting head of strategy, Ms. Marty Albert, who is also in our strategy unit, Mr. Teboho Setabela, who is our acting head of finance, and we have, unfortunately, Ms. Kari Gamwa is not able to join us today, but Advocate Pierre Smith from the Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit is present. And I must also apologize at this stage that Advocate Hermione Cronier is not able to be present with us. She is, we are fully aware of the importance of these briefings. She is in an extremely important meeting that might result in some action, hopefully in the very foreseeable future. So she's caught up in that meeting, but we are here to deal with questions relating to the ID. And if there are any matters, there are ID representatives on this platform. And in the event that we need her to come in at a later stage to answer any questions, we will certainly do so, Chair. And we also have Mr. Sipho Mgwema, my spokesperson, who is present. And I hope, colleagues, I haven't missed out anyone. Okay, thank you very much, Chair. Chair, it is 2 years and 2 months since I took office as the National Director of Public Prosecutions. It's been a rewarding...
It was 10 years.
It feels like it, Chair. It feels like it. But hopefully in 10 years, you're going to be seeing a completely different NPA with a whole lot of people in orange overalls. So it's been 2 years and 2 months. And, you know, as I said, it's been hugely rewarding, but immensely challenging. And, you know, the task of rebuilding this really important institution, is no mean feat. But I'm really pleased that I am now supported by four very competent Deputy National Directors of Public Prosecutions. And this makes a huge difference in terms of us seeing the fruits of our rebuilding efforts in the near future. So, Chair, we continue to have immense challenges. And the important thing is that we are prevailing as the NPA. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. The rule of law might be battered, but it is very far from defeated. And we are here to ensure that we uphold it at all costs. Chair, I realize we have a long way to go, but today I present our annual performance plan as well as our priority plans with full confidence that the NPA has the ability to deliver justice to the people of South Africa. The minister reminded us, and importantly so, that we cannot legislate the consciousness of citizens. So in as much as we are going to do everything we possibly can, we really, all of us, have a duty and an obligation to be contributing members towards a just society, a law-abiding society, and one in which there is less greed, Chair. The minister indicated that it's not the ideas that make the difference, but implementation and hard work. And as the head of the NPA, I realized that the honeymoon days were long over, actually. Although we present a plan today, and today is in fact forward-looking, so it is about what we intend to do, what our priorities are for the next year ahead. So it's very much forward-looking, but we realize that we need to deal with what we have been perhaps to a certain extent doing to make sure that we are firmly action orientated for impact, Chair. Chair, with those few words, I now find that the slides are not moving. It was moving a minute ago. No. It moved. Sorry, Chair, we're getting back to you. It moved just as, oh, there you go, thank you. So Chair, this is very briefly the presentation outline. The presentation has been sent to colleagues, so I'm not going to talk to this slide, but move straight on to the next slide. Chair, what is really important is that our work in this coming year and in the years to come has got to be impactful, and it's all about delivery in a very, very challenging environment. And in this context, Chair, we cannot underestimate the importance of ensuring that we are able to measure the impact of our work, and that we are able to deliver through innovation and by ensuring and that we have an ethical NPA, and that we engaged ethically, and that when the prosecutor speaks, whether it's in court or anywhere else, magistrates and our partners and the country must know that they are dealing with people of the highest standards of ethics, and that we can be trusted. And so, Chair, we committed to ensuring that we're able to measure the impact of our work. We committed to transformation and, importantly, modernization that the minister talked about, both transformation and modernization. And there's so many aspects of transforming an organization. And so we are going to ensure that we actually deliver through our established values. And the NPA has its values, but we want to ensure that these are not just words. You know, when we talk about service excellence, when we talk about professionalism, when we talk about integrity, that it's not just words, but that these things are demonstrated in the way that we perform our work. And these are manifested in what we refer to as our IPAC pillars. IPAC standing for independent, professional, accountable, and credible. And these are the four pillars of our strategy. And we are in the process of developing a roadmap to ensure that these IPAC pillars, as we call it, are again not just words, they're not just rhetoric, but that we develop a roadmap so that at the end of certainly the MTSF period, but hopefully sooner, we're able to say that, well, in the very near future, we would be able to say, what does an independent prosecutor look like? What does a professional prosecuting authority look like? Similarly accountable and credible. And we will be able to, we are establishing roadmaps. Each one of the deputy national directors is the owner of each of those pillars. And we will be able to show at the end of the period that we can measure that the NPA is objectively an independent, professional, accountable, and credible organization. Our APP chair is rather ambitious when one considers the immense challenges that we are facing and the challenges not just in our internal environment, within the NPA itself. Still, there are huge challenges. Within the criminal justice system, there are huge challenges, but also the challenges that come with the COVID-19 pandemic, which make the times that we're in hugely uncertain. Chair, during 2021-2022, it is important to prioritize. Chair, someone said that if everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. And so we have to really sharpen our focus to ensure that we're able to deliver impactfully in terms of our APP moving forward. And so we have committed to the four priorities that I'll mention now, and they are designed to deliver game changers. Chair, you recall at our last session, that the issue of what are the game changers that the NPA will put in place to ensure that you are able to deliver on this really onerous mandate. And so the four priorities that we've determined at our delivery workshop that we held earlier in March was one, and it's no surprise, is expediting high-profile corruption cases both provincially and nationally. The second one is a focus on serious, violent, and organized crime. And Chair, I mentioned this, I must say, it is not just the NPA. We've got to do this with our partners because, you know, the NPA really, except for the ID, to a certain extent in terms of dealing with corruption, everything else that the NPA does is reliant on partners to ensure that we have high-level investigations that we can take to court. And so we want to focus on these quality of life crimes and crimes that disproportionately undermine public safety. And in this regard, we are looking at the statistics, and together with our colleagues in SAPS, we are looking to identify particular crime types that we want to focus on, for example, housebreaking, so that we can really make an impact in terms of people feeling safer in South Africa. Because, you know, we have often, it's been raised in the portfolio committee that yes, conviction rates are great, and you know, it's good to have 80% conviction rates, but does that translate into a reduction in crime levels? Does it translate to people feeling safer? And we want to make sure that our work does translate into those high-level impactful outcomes. Capacitating the organization is a top priority. You know, the NPA was found seriously depleted in terms of capacity. We've made really big strides in this regard. There's still a lot of work to be done. And so we are still really prioritizing getting on board the additional skills, the expertise, capabilities, in order to ensure that we can really expeditiously respond to all of the current priorities, as well as a number of emerging priorities. And the final priority that we've established, we've determined for this year, is enhancing staff morale and well-being. And in this regard, there's a number of initiatives that we are putting in place. Our HR colleagues online on this platform will be able to add to it, but we are putting in place a cultural enhancement project, and they can talk more about that. Just this week, we circulated the draft harassment policy to all members of the NPA. Harassment includes all kinds of harassment, including sexual harassment, types of discrimination. And so that policy has been circulated for comment, but there are a number of initiatives. This is an important priority for the NPA this year. Chair, in terms of the first priority, that is dealing with high-profile corruption, Chair, the reality is that although it may not appear to be so at this point because of the incredible challenges that we've had, but the reality is that the investigating directorate is a game changer. And the reason why I say that is because, in as much as we are working extremely well, I want to highlight this, we're working really well with our colleagues in the DPCI in terms of dealing with high-level corruption cases outside of the ID. There's really, our relationship has been cemented, and I don't want to undermine that in any way, because there's really good work that's happening in that space. The ID brings a new methodology in that we know it's investigators, prosecutors, analysts, and a whole lot of other disciplines that are needed to effectively investigate and prosecute high-level corruption under one space, under one roof. And that in itself is hugely important. But and in as much as the really big cases that people want to come to court have not yet come to court, I am absolutely confident that the work that has happened in the past 2 years, it has really, put in place a firm foundation to deal with high-level corruption within the ID space. There have been a number of teething problems, and I can just mention some of them. You know, the ID requires, a whole lot of additional capacities, capabilities. And it's been a real challenge to bring on board, for example, financial investigators. There was no provision, in the NPA to bring these different types of skills. So we've had to do lots of work and groundwork in terms of being able to bring on board these skills. And so in January this year, after 2 years after the ID was set up, we brought on board 24 financial investigators that actually started work in the ID. In addition, the State Capture Commission, honorable members will recall there was a change to the regulations of the commission last year in July, and that has made a really big impact in terms of allowing the commission to share information with law enforcement, not just with the ID. And so this is working well. We are sharing a lot more information, but the reality is that the commission is still working. And so there are some challenges with regard to bringing cases where evidence is still going to be led in the commission, for example. And there are some challenges with a full-scale migration of resources in terms of people, other resources, other capabilities. But the forensic lab in the Zondo Commission is in the process of also being migrated. And so we are able to already, there are some investigators and legal people that have been slowly are being migrated into the investigating directorate. And so that is why I say that the ID is in fact poised to make significant progress on priority matters. And the asset forfeiture part of it, you would have read just in recent times, Chair, there's also, in the recent weeks, there's also been some really good successes in that regard. So this, I feel very confident that this capacity that was set up to deal with high-level corruption is, in fact, on the brink of making some significant inroads or certainly taking some significant action. But there's still a long road to go, Chair. We are by no means where we would like to be, but things are very much improved in this space. The asset forfeiture unit, Chair, what are the game changers in this particular area that we see? The first one is the co-location of investigators, the DPCI investigators, and the together in the NPA regional offices. Now, this may not seem like a big deal, but Chair, this is a huge deal. The co-located model of the NPA AFU staff as well as the DPCI investigators was a very successful model, about between 6 and 10 years ago. But for some reason, that model was dismantled. And so Advocate Rabaji has been, and even myself initially, had discussions with General De Beer, and there's been an agreement now that the financial investigation capabilities within the DPCI are now going to be co-located with the asset forfeiture professionals in the AFU. And this, Chair, will make a huge difference. And so we are very excited about this development. Advocate Rabaji can already talk to some of the successes that have already been streaming through in this particular space. And I want to say, Chair, we often talk about asset forfeiture only in the context of, or primarily in the context of, high-level corruption. But when you look at some of the cases recently that the asset forfeiture unit has been dealing with, there is even the potential for asset forfeiture in gender-based violence and femicide cases. There was a particular case where there was a vehicle in Polokwane that was stopped and searched by the police, and they were found the head of a young woman was found in this car, and they were then linked to the killing of a 17-year-old young child, and Intabiseng Mosomane. And in this particular case, the asset forfeiture unit acted and seized the motor vehicle, and it was then forfeited to the state, although it was an amount of only 15,000 rands at the end of the day that came into CARA. But it shows that we were able to, asset forfeiture is an instrument that can be used in so many different contexts. I'm not going to go into too much of detail on this, but there have been other really good recent asset forfeiture cases with regard to environmental crimes, with regard to illicit financial flows. And I can certainly say that under the leadership of Advocate Rabaji, together now with her able lieutenant in Advocate Priya Baseswa, two competent women, asset forfeiture is certainly going to show a lot more results in the near future. There've also been, the issue of strengthening relationships with the South African Reserve Bank, as well as with the Financial Intelligence Center. These are hugely important strategic relationships. And so the kind of, recently an MOU was signed with the Financial Intelligence Center. And what this does is it allows us to really fast track asset forfeiture recovery, and it prevents dissipation. In fact, what we have done is we've actually placed one of our asset forfeiture professionals in the Financial Intelligence Center so that we can fast track these cases and make more impact. In the Northwest intervention, this is also a priority for the NPA. We've been working very well with our partners in this area. there wasn't an asset forfeiture footprint in the Northwest, but we have hired staff there, and there are already some cases that are coming through in the Northwest. With regard to prioritizing cases within the NPA, this might also seem a bit strange, but you know, when I took office, the relationship between the Asset Forfeiture Unit and the National Prosecution Service, both in the NPA, was surprising to say the least, because there was no collaboration. It was, they were working in silos, and the prosecutors had no ideas what the asset forfeiture staff were doing. The asset forfeiture didn't know what was going on with the prosecutions. And as we know, with the Chapter 5 confiscations, which is conviction based, you need the cases to move quicker so that the money can be recovered. So that relationship between the NPS and the AFU is hugely strengthened. And that is also going to, and together with the SCCU, and that's going to make a huge difference in terms of moving forward. Chair, the AFU has been on a massive capacity drive. And so, you know, bringing on board forensic capabilities, project managers, and we're also looking at bringing on board aspirant advocates that will actually, young aspirant advocates, and ensuring that we contribute to transformation and that we bring on board young legal professionals that can actually assist with asset recovery. The management of curators is a big deal, Chair, and this has, the poor management of curators has resulted in a lot of costs for the organization. And Advocate Rabaji has really put in place measures to ensure that we, moving forward, we effectively manage curators and that we are not wasting money that should be going into CARA by paying curators unnecessarily high fees or fees that they are not entitled to. Chair, there are other examples of, they are what we hope would be game changers. These are initiatives that we are working on. The Community Prosecution Initiative is a really important initiative in that it is about prosecutors really working more with our partners, including with the community, to ensure that we proactively deal with crime in certain high crime areas. There was a pilot project in the NPA some 10 years ago, and so in order to ensure that we are more accessible to the people of South Africa, together with our partners, including the police primarily, but in fact, primarily the community, we want to ensure that prosecutors work towards finding solutions with the community to certain high levels of crime in certain identified areas. I mentioned housebreaking. We want to engage with our partners. The statistics have shown that housebreaking is continuously on the rise, and it is one crime that instills the most fear in South Africans. And so we are looking to see how we can become more strategic in terms of how we deal with specific crimes, so that we're not all over the place and not making any impact, but together with our partners, we prioritize and we focus on certain crime types so that we can make impacts on the lives of ordinary South Africans. The issue of building a forensic capability for government is a huge, is in fact potentially a massive game changer in terms of dealing with corruption and dealing with asset forfeiture as well moving forward. This is something that is being, has been identified as one of the legacy projects, let's put it, of the economic recovery strategy of the JCPS. So the ACTT is coordinating. So this is a joint initiative by the relevant key role players within law enforcement. And so there is a task team that's working on this. And so we're certainly hoping that you know, the wheels in this regard will be, they are certainly turning, but, and this is not a short-term project, But we are certainly hoping that in you know, the not too distant future, we will have a forensic capability for government, because government spends a fortune on all of these forensic reports that we need, and it's time that we actually invested in that capacity in government. The increased use of information technology and digitization. Chair, in this regard, the minister also talked about modernization, and so this is a huge part of our strategy. We are looking at, we've already, you know, we want to capacitate prosecutors with the tools that they need to ensure that they are able to be fully on board with the modernization projects. And so if there's questions on this, we've certainly, there's a project, there's a change management process to get prosecutors more on board with this. And so this is a huge priority moving forward. Recruiting, training, and retaining of the right staff. You know, there's been no, we are looking at really trying to be innovative in how we recruit, train the right staff. So, you know, building certain capabilities in the NPA that in the past were perhaps not, normally capabilities that one would have. So we are really looking at capacitating, and the asset forfeiture unit is a classic example of really getting other capabilities, the ID similarly, but we're also looking at project management capabilities. So we are, you know, there's a lot of work that's going on too in terms of the skills development and training of staff. And here the final you know, priority that I talked about was staff wellness and ensuring that we have a motivated and you know, inspired workforce. Chair, maybe I'll just deal with the fact you mentioned, and one of the issues that is on our table with regard to staff wellness issues or motivated staff is the issue of the LP10 situation, where you mentioned that the you know, the deputy directors are, as supervisors, are earning less money than those that they supervise at the LP9 level. This is something that is of huge concern to the organization. The matter is in the Supreme Court of Appeal at the moment. So we are waiting for that decision, which we hope will be out soon. But in the meantime, we are preparing in the organization for different scenarios that could emerge, so that we are able to address this disparity in with regard to the salaries of the deputies as well as the chief prosecutors and those that they supervise. Chair, the issue of the sexual and gender-based crimes has always been a priority for the organization. It remains a priority, and with the appointment of the new special director, you know, I want to thank Advocate Pierre Smith, who acted in that position for a number of years and did an amazing work, did amazing work in that sphere. Now we have Advocate Bonnie Curry Gamo, who comes with a new energy. I think it's always good to have change. It comes in with a new energy, and so she is really looking at, we are doing an evaluation of all the Tutuzela care centres. We know that some of them are not as efficient as others. So we want to make sure that blueprint for service in the Tutuzela care centre is in fact one that is the same across, that is in fact in place, that the services that are in place with all our partners is uniform across the country, and that where there are gaps, they are addressed. So that is a big part of the drive. And so, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we're also looking, Chair, at a national capacity to coordinate the work of the Tutuzela care centers. That has been a bit challenging, because some of the departments don't have, you know, are the provincial departments as opposed to the national ones. But we're certainly working with our partners to see how there can be better coordination in the Tutuzela care centers. Chair, all that I've said, these are all linked to the high-level strategic outcomes that we've set up that are in our 5-year strategic plan. And just to recall these, Chair, these are really very lofty ideals. I mean, we don't just want to achieve high conviction rates. We do want to increase feelings of safety and security. We don't just want to have high conviction rates in corruption and other commercial crime cases. We want to improve investor confidence in the country. And finally, we want to ensure that the people of South Africa have better access to the NPA services. Chair, some of the key interventions moving forward this year is the setting up. Firstly, I mentioned earlier, Chair, the importance of having staff members, not just prosecutors, but we have administrative capabilities, we have other professionals in the organizations. We want to ensure that across the board, no matter what you do, we have people of the highest standards of integrity and ethics. And so the NPA Act provides for the setting up of such a capability. And we are in the process of doing this. We are setting up an Office of Complaints and Ethics. That's the working title for now, Chair. But we certainly hope that by the end of this year, this office will be set up and that it would in fact be operational in the early part of next year. Chair, this particular intervention talks to priority number 4, which is related to staff wellness and morale. Chair, another important intervention that we initiated already last year, that is still an important part of the capacitation of the NPA with new fresh blood, so to speak, Chair, is the Aspirant Prosecutor Program. And here where, you know, this particular program has the ability to really change the lives and prospects of young South Africans. And last year, we took on board 425, young South Africans. And in this regard, it also helps us to contribute in some way towards youth unemployment in this country and to really give young South Africans opportunities within the National Prosecuting Authority. As you can see, the average age of aspirant prosecutors is 28, and we've set out the breakdown of the intake last year in terms of the gender and other diversity issues, Chair. So now coming to the compliance part of the annual performance plan, Chair, this has been, the presentation has been shared with the committee. I'm not going to go into too much of detail on this. We'd be happy to take questions on it. But as you can see, Chair, with regard to the first sub-outcome, which is increased feelings of safety and security, the conviction rates in the High Court, Regional Court, and District Court are all there, and the targets are set out. We've added conviction rate in cable theft, and this is a new indicator, Chair. And the reason why we've actually put this in is because this was brought in as an indicator at the MTSS level. And although in the past this was being measured at the lower level of the National Prosecuting Service operational plan, we've now elevated it to the NPA plan. And it's also, you know, a matter of national interest. It's a matter that has an impact on our economy. So this matter has now been elevated. And it's not just about the conviction rate, but there's also the asset forfeiture possibilities that would go along with cases of that nature. And then the last indicator relates to witness protection and the number of witnesses that are threatened, harmed, killed whilst on witness protection. And of course, we certainly want that number to remain zero. Chair, sub-outcome 2, which is improved investor confidence in South Africa through high impact prosecutions. This deals with complex commercial crimes. And there you can see the indicators in terms of conviction rates, the number of persons that are convicted of private sector corruption, and the number of government officials convicted. And continuing with sub-outcome 2, Chair, dealing with fraud and corruption. Money laundering is a really important issue. It's an issue that also talks to our international obligations. It talks to illicit financial flows. And so we are really focusing on, because even in corruption cases, Chair, we found that we have money laundering as additional charges, but we all know that there are entities like banks, like accountants, like insurance agencies, like lawyers that played a big role in laundering money. And so we really need to be looking at focusing on these entities that have also been played a big role in corruption in this country. And then the asset forfeiture targets, Chair, the value of freezing orders obtained and the value of recoveries obtained are set out in this slide, Chair. And the final sub-outcome is improve access to NPA services for all. We want to ensure a victim-centric services, and so the measures or indicators here relate to the operational TCCs, and then to conviction rate in sexual offences. And Chair, here again, I must say, you know, the conviction rate in sexual offences has always been consistently high with regard to the cases that come to the National Prosecuting Authority. But when one compares this to the number of reported cases, it's actually a very, very small percentage. And this is a hugely important issue. You know, we and my colleagues online, I mean, if we have questions, but we've got numbers of the very, very high sentences, life over 20 years that the courts are meeting out, the high conviction rates. But the reality is we're not addressing this scourge. And the point I make, Chair, is that it's got to go beyond the criminal justice system if we really want to, as a country, deal with the scourge of sexual and gender-based violence. And the last indicator in this regard, Chair, relates to public awareness sessions. The NPA wants to engage more with the communities and to be out there in terms of making people, making the citizens of this country aware of what we do and how they can better access our services in particular, Chair. Chair, that brings me to the end of my part. I'm going to now hand you over to Teboho Setabela, who's going to be doing the budget overview, Chair. So I'm going to have to swap chairs with him. So if you'll just give us one moment while we make sure we deal with, we are still, we're not muted, Karen. Thank you. Just a moment, Chair. I'm going to move over. So maybe I can just turn that towards you and then I will, won't have to swap chairs.
Thank you, NDPP, Afternoon Chair and committee members. Thank you, NDPP. Thank you, Chair. Just as a way of starting, Chair, this is the slide relating to our previous financial year expenditure. This is unaudited figures, as the Auditor General is still busy with the audit for the financial year. But just as an overall, Chair, you'll realize that the NPA overall in terms of the budget, we have spent 98.36% of our budget. The expenditure, I'm going to just go through to the items per economic classification. Compensation of employees, we have spent, Chair, 97%. This is the area where we had over just about 100 million rand underspending. This was the underspending was just as a way of recruitment and due to the COVID-19 lockdown that disturbed our recruitment process. But as we speak, our recruitment process is still underway. We continue to that. When we get to the goods and services, Chair, we have an overspending of about 29 million rand, where we are over 106%. And the other line item where we're overspending on it is the transfer and subsidiaries. The goods and services, Chair, generally what happens is it was relating to the equipment that we bought for the new intake of our prosecutors. But however, the expense was absorbed by the Department of Justice, which came in and assisted us with the overspending, which we are very grateful of it, with relating to that. As we proceed with the expenses relating to that, the other ones on that is overspending, it's on machinery and equipment that's relating to the laptops. The transfers just basically relate to the leave gratuity and transitor agencies that we are paying. If I proceed, Chair, onto your next slide, this is our allocation for the 2021-22 in terms of the A&E allocation. You will notice that, Chair, our budget is just around 3.8 billion. However, you will notice over the OMTF allocation, our budget has not much really grown. It's over 2%, which is way below the inflation rate. Mm. Our biggest concern, Chair, at this point in time is our budget around the goods and services. As the NPA is busy recruiting and intaking number, we're having a challenge, particularly under the machinery and equipment, where it's our the equipment in terms of IT laptops for our prosecutors, where we our budget is quite significantly very low. We are very concerned about that because over the years, our budget keeps on depreciating and we will face a situation where we are unable to provide our prosecutors and overall employees with the tools of trade to be able to do the job. However, even though the NPA has sufficient budget within the compensation of employees over the outer years, we remain very much optimistic that we'll be able to do the recruitment and fill the vacant posts. As you can see, Chair, this is the progress that we've been doing throughout. As it's also planned for this financial year to have another intake of the aspirant prosecutor program that we're pursuing. The other classification that we have is the transfers and subsidies. That's a budget which we are not necessarily much worried about. But as I said, the biggest concern that we would like to highlight to the committee, particularly relating to the initiatives that the NPA is taking, that the goods and services will remain a challenge. Even though we're monitoring it, but it will remain a challenge, and we'd like to highlight that this is the biggest problem for us, particularly under the capital. We don't have much of the capital budget around that, and we anticipate that we might have a challenge, but this will also be canvassed with our Department of Justice to try and assist with regard to those issues. I think, Chair, these are most likely the high level of it. If there's much more details that is required, we're willing to provide. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Chair, just a moment, just making sure we comply with all these protocols. So, Chair, that is the budget overview, and I really want to emphasize the point that Teboho Setabela just made with regard to the goods and services budget. We really have a lot of work to do, and we want to ensure that, you know, we have, you know, inspired prosecutors who have, you know, are properly capacitated, that we have, you know, we talked about modernization, and we really want to be a cutting edge prosecution service that can deliver on the challenges of the 21st century. And so in order to do that, it's great. We're very grateful for the funding that we've got that has allowed us to really bring on board a number of more staff members. But there's still a lot of hard work, you know, that's needed in order for us to ensure that we're able to deliver. And so with the budget increase of, if you really look at it, we've got money, but it's only a 2% increase over the period. And so that is a very, very small increase. And so we know that we are working on hugely financially constrained times. We know that there's very little money, but the NPA is poised to, in fact, to deliver a good return on the investment. Let me put it that way. And so, Chair, I think the NPA is an entity that, if we are able to do our work properly, and we're able to recover the money, we're able to properly prosecute and get people behind bars, we will increase investor confidence. We will be able to recover you know, the lost assets, and we will be able to make an impact on the economy, which will benefit the country as a whole. So I think the goods and services budget is of huge concern to us. And so we just, as Teboho said, we want to highlight that. But I also want to make the point, Chair, that in order for us to deliver, we got to look at capacitating our key partner, and that is the SAPS, in particular the DPCI. And it's hugely important that they are able to deliver quality investigations to the NPA. And they also support us in asset forfeiture investigations. So it's really important that the DPCI gets the necessary resources so that we can properly deal with the South Africa's crime problems. And so, Chair, that is the presentation of the NPA. I thank you, and we stand ready to take questions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, NPPP, and to your team. Can you remove the slide?
I'm going to stop sharing now, Chair, in a moment, and I'm going to just deal with the mute myself so that we're not echoing.
Okay, thank you very much. Can I note hands from members? I have Honorable Glenis Breitenbach, Honorable Jelle, Honorable Swart, Honorable Nevot Drachens, in that order, Honorable Danji. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And just now, my dog decides to make a noise. Just 1 second. Good afternoon, everybody, and
I think that dog needs food. That dog.
He's about as round as you are, Richard. He doesn't need food. He needs exercise. So I'm just going to be quiet for heaven's sake. I'm going to smack you. I'd like to know, first of all, about the... the NDPP mentioned the LP, I'm going to move you. The LP10 issue. So it is 2 years and 2 months, as you correctly point out. And nothing has happened. Nothing has happened on that score.
Honorable Breitenbach,
yes.
Maybe we'll give you a minute or so.
No, no, it's fine. The dog is gone now. Okay. My neighbor's dogs are in his garden, and so my dog's barking at them. So nothing has happened on that score. You've taken the matter on appeal, and you're awaiting an outcome in the Supreme Court of Appeal. So what effectively happened is that the deputy directors won their matter, and when they won it, you took it on appeal. That doesn't do a lot for building morale, in my view. It doesn't do a lot for building up corporate goodwill, in my view. I don't know what the reasons are for your taking it on appeal. I must say, it strikes me as odd. But be that as it may, I know that you're waiting for the Supreme Court of Appeal. I know that in the Labor Court, they lost. Not sure why. I haven't seen a judgment. But I do know that they've been granted leave to appeal in the Labor Court, and they're going to appeal. So what we have is the deputy directors, the main body of your senior management, at odds with you. It's not good. It doesn't look good. It doesn't sound good. It certainly doesn't make them feel good. And what's happening at the moment is, of course, you're appointing senior state advocates to deputy director post as they get promoted, quite correctly, but they come off an LP10. And so they're already earning more than the job they're applying for. And so what you're doing is you're appointing them at the top scale of deputy director because they're already earning that money. And so they earn, as we used to say, a blowhard, a baby deputy director is earning more currently than deputy directors who've been there for 10 and 20 years. I don't know how that can be described as fair. I don't know how that can be described as acceptable. I don't lack the words to describe it. I just can't say them on this platform. So please, can you help me with it? I don't understand. And could you please help me with that? Then the Office of Innovation is a new thing. sounds good on paper. Has it in fact been created? Is it doing anything? And if so, what? There were a number of COVID-related corruption matters that were enrolled. There were a couple being a lot being considered, a couple enrolled, some thrown out. What is the progress with the prosecution of those matters? And then I'd like to know the current total number of prosecutors in the MPA, if you have that information to hand. And if you don't, you can answer this in writing. And then the current conviction rate per prosecutor. Also, if you don't have that to hand, you can answer it in writing. That's absolutely fine. I noticed that there is a growing number of cases being finalized by way of informal mediation. I'm not too sure what that is. Upon reflection, it certainly would have potential benefits for everybody, I agree. But what does it entail precisely, and what kind of oversight supervision is there of the matters that are being dealt with in that session? Does somebody check the outcomes? Is there some sort of control over that process? Could we have an update on the progress of the Life SC Dimeni inquest, please? And then high-profile matters such as the Basasa case, the Steinhoff case, there's really little to no movement there. Could we have an update on the progress, please? And then the Fusion Center, the anti-corruption task team, much wanted. Very little action. They appear to be non-functional. Can we have an update on progress there, please? Then there have been, as you mentioned, some really encouraging results with regards to asset forfeiture, to extraditions, to people being arrested abroad. And all that's good. Yes, it does look like there's light at the end of the tunnel. You say you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I hope it's not an oncoming train. It is looking better. It is looking better, which is very, very gratifying. I think I understand the magnitude of the job that you've had to do, so well done. There is progress. Then finally, I would like an update on the Bobrov matter. Mr. Bobrov Senior, well, they were annihilated in the asset forfeiture issue, and that's gave everybody warm and fuzzy feelings. But when are they coming back to face justice? Mr. Bobrov sits in Australia and has a lot to say about the criminal justice system in South Africa, about personalities in the criminal justice system in South Africa, tries to get people not appointed as judges in South Africa while he's cowering under a rock somewhere in Australia. It's time he came back to face the music. I'd like an update on the Bobrovs, please. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jala.
Thank you very much, Chair. To piggyback on what, thank you very much, Advocate Batoy, and the beautiful look also. You know, they always say that women don't see that. We do, huh? You are really, you know, beautiful. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to piggyback on that one of Mr. Bob coming home and all that, but I'll come with the angle Advocate Batoy of saying maybe we also have to be given a light as to the criteria that the IG uses in choosing these cases, so that at least we know exactly. But we know that last time when they were here reporting, they were saying some of the cases indeed are difficult. There are so many issues that they still have to consider. But if we can get light as to when you choose at the end, what is it that you are looking for? But Also, we appreciate indeed the work that you have already done. The reports and also the atmosphere gives us assurance that indeed there is something happening in your in your institution with your team. But I also want to applaud the work of the AFU. But we want them to add, to make sure that they bring back that money. We want that money. Our country needs the money so much. So we are saying, let them do more in order to make sure that that money comes back so that we can be able to augment and use it in other places. And then the other one that I want to also comment on is on the issues of the Tutuzela centers. Yes, we really, at the moment, it's quiet, you know, in terms of the complaints that we used to get, a lot of them, about these centers. But now I can see that even the community is, we are getting there. But also, let me say, if we can get a report from your team as to the impact that that these Tutuzelas have in our communities up to this far, if you can get a little a detail on that one. I also would like to acknowledge the new indicators that you are coming up with. In fact, we are happy. This is what we are encouraging, that you need to come with a innovative, new and innovative, so that we can see that this car is moving. So when you talk about, now we are putting, for example, the one that the indicator on the cable theft, that one is it's very important. But I see there you have put 74%. So maybe you can also give us light as to why 74, I was going to say, why not 80 or 90? Because of the magnitude of the problems that we have in this area. Maybe if you can just share with us, how did you come to this 74%? Then the last two ones that I have, I think this one of them, I was going to say if we can get more details also on the issue of the community prosecutions initiatives, just a little bit information also on that one. Lastly, Advocate Patoy would be on the, can we also get explanations on the reasons behind the removal of the level, this indicator, the level of quality prosecution as a performance indicator. That one, that is the last one, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the NDPP, Advocate Patoki, for your presentation. I want to share the sentiments of Advocate Breitenbach that things are definitely looking better, and I want to commend you for the work that you and all your staff are doing under very, very difficult conditions. I understand the complexity of a lot of the matters that you're dealing with, but I do see progress, and I'd also would like to encourage you that the light at the end of the tunnel is not necessarily a coming train. Let's hope it's not the portfolio committee that is watching you very closely. But we do want to commend you. I missed a bit of the initial input. So if you did raise the issue of the impact, the impact of mutual legal assistance and extraditions. Chair, I'm not sure if that was covered earlier. If it was, but I'm particularly interested in having sat on the ESCOM inquiry when we had all these Guptas, Salim Essa sitting in South Africa, and we even issued, as Parliament issued a subpoena for them to appear, and they didn't. It's disgraceful that they are now sitting overseas, and I would like to ask you about your cooperation in that regard, to get them back to South Africa. And of course, we see the UK, the Minister of Justice welcomed the steps of the UK when it came to freezing of assets relating to that in particular. So I'd like you to give us more details. If you have covered it, I understand that. I do commend the issue, the asset forfeiture unit, and this morning, if you had heard me, I made an impassioned plea earlier that it makes no sense to me to decrease the funding of the SIU, National Prosecuting Authority, Asset Forfeiture Unit, the ID, the Hawks, and the department that are running the courts, when billions can be collected, when investor confidence can be improved, and when people can feel safer in their homes, businesses, and public places. It makes no logical sense to me. And so, Chair, I do recall the Minister of Finance indicating he'd heard me from the ACDP pleading for more finances. More finances were given, but now we see budget cuts for the SIU, and this cannot be supported by this committee. But I just want to commend the Asset Forfeiture Unit. What I would like to specifically ask is relating to the game changers, relating to, and we welcome those, we welcome the belated cooperation with other law entities, Intelligence Centre, the SA Reserve Bank. The question rises, how could all these billions of rands left the country when there are so many, if I want to send 10,000 rand overseas, there are so many forms I have to fill in. How do all these funds, how did they leave the country? But that's historical. We're looking now to the present and the cooperation with the Auditor General, and I'd like to specifically focus in on the cooperation with the South African Revenue Services. We know that one of the greatest gangsters in history, Al Capone, was eventually jailed on tax evasion. None other of the gang. And they've got quick wins. They've got so many powers. So I'd like you to unpack your cooperation with SARS. They've got, as much as you've got Asset Forfeiture Unit, SARS has got, they can immediately issue a Section 88 notice where they appoint a bank as an agent for a delinquent taxpayer. So I would ask you that cooperation, because they indicated, the Commissioner for Inland Revenue, a SARS Commissioner this week told Scopa that they're working on 7 state capture-related projects. They have got 500 active cases in that project, up to 4 billion rand, 85 civil matters, 58 criminal matters, and they've handed 27 criminal cases to the NPA. So that was this week, and I presume you could give us an update of the prosecution that would be on tax evasion in terms of their legislation. Now, to what degree does Section 4, I think, of the Revenue of the Tax Act prohibit you from using that tax-related information in criminal court? Surely not. Surely not. But I would expect that you'd be able to use those powers as well somehow to recover those taxes that people have evaded taxes when we see it. And I must say, looking at the newspapers almost on a daily basis, one does become discouraged when you see the levels of corruption. You made some very broad comments last year about the broad corruption. We see now with the Turkish powership proposed tender of a 20-year tender, we see that sitting in the High Court of litigation already, allegations of corruption. We see that in a civil matter. We see that there are allegations against government officials in the Mineral Resources Center that are saying, this is the system. Get with the system, i.e. get with the corrupt system. That is how we operate. And clearly, this will take some time to change that systemic corruption that you have referred to, that we all are deeply concerned about. And it will change when we have some high-level prosecutions, which are, we understand, are taking place, and we commend you for that understanding. The forensics is obviously the big issue. On that particular issue, I'm not sure if you're able to comment on the Steinhoff matter and the usage of Steinhoff, the company, funding forensic investigation into certain previous CEOs, understanding, and that's a Hawks issue. If you don't want to comment on that, I appreciate that, but it does illustrate the difficulty that Hawks has with forensic capacities. In that particular case, it's a large amount. It's a couple of hundred million for the funding of a forensic investigation. And I understand the Hawks indicating that if they're not able to have that company funding their audit and forensics, they will not be able to prosecute that matter or investigate it properly. But it does lead to a possible conflict of interest, and it indicates how difficult these matters are. I think you also made a very pertinent comment about the role of the private sector in a lot of this corruption. I think that is something we need to bear very much in mind. And the auditors, the lawyers, we had more than enough evidence in our parliamentary ESCOM inquiry, which was a lot of that evidence has now been handed over to the Zondo Commission. So that is a whole nother issue that I'm sure you are investigating as well. The last issue which I would like to just unpack with you is the issue of, it's just escaped me now, but the issue of the Zondo Commission and the regulations in terms of the Zondo Commission, which the Advocate Cronier indicated was a game changer. Now, it's a bit of a concern to me that there's still a discussion ongoing with National Treasury where they've given an undertaking to locate cyber technology of the Zondo Commission in the NPA. That's according to your slide 5. Can we be of assistance in that regard from an oversight perspective? Because we don't want that technology, the Zondo Commission comes to an end in June. What is going to happen to all that technology immediately? What's going to happen to all those investigators? Are they going to go across to the Hawks or to the NPA? Is there funding for that? Because we know that from the Minister of Finance's perspective, no more funding to the Zondo Commission. So what's going to happen there? We need to be proactive in looking for those additional resources. We don't want to lose all that capacity that's been built up over years. And so, Chair, from my perspective, I'm deeply interested at what the Zondo Commission is finished in June. What happens?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Honorable,
and thank you for allowing me to be a bit more broad and expansive.
Thank you. Honorable Nicole Jachens.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, everyone, and good afternoon, NDPP and your team. Thank you for the presentation. And I would like to start with the cable theft. I'm very happy that you've added cable theft and congratulate you on all the successes in terms of that. But also with regard to cable theft relating to the burning of trains. I live close to the railway line that goes to town, and I'm quite concerned about the burning of trains as well, because it's the heartbeat of the economy and economic development, especially in Cape Town. People need transport, and they need the trains to travel to work. So if cable theft happens, the trains stop, there's no power, and many things happen because of that. So I'm just curious with regard to what you're doing with regard to that. Then on slide 16, I see with regards to recovery of money and assets, I see that there was an audit in 2019-20, but I see there's another few years after that, it was less, it was 1.4. Why the reduction? Why is it not kept at 3.5, you know, over the years? Why is there a reduction? And then I would also like to know the DNA testing, the backlog of DNA testing. How is the NPA assisting, or what is the NPA doing to assist to reduce the backlog of the DNA testing? Because that links to most of the gender-based violence prosecutions as well. And the testing needs to be available for that as evidence. So what is happening with regard to the backlog? What is being done? Then Honorable Jele did mention with regard to the Tutuzela care centers. I was very impressed when I visited one. You know, I thought all of them are the same throughout, and I thought it was standard. But as you said, it needs to be reviewed because not all of them are the same. So can you give an example of why they are not standardized, why they are not the same, and what is not the same? And I saw somewhere the expenses on COVID. I mean, all the things that we need to prevent COVID from spreading. What has been the cost and the expenses with regard to COVID? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Judge.
Nkosi Sihlalo, thank you very much. Let me also thank the 2.5 years old baby. I think we're traveling this journey with her. You know, when she was 9 months old, we're very hard on her before she was born. So. Come on. Thank you. No, ignore him. I'm just saying it's been very hectic 2 years because we correctly had to put a lot of pressure on you given where the country was. And I think this time around, we're not just looking at documents. We're meeting with you and we're able to reflect on actions that the entire nation can see. That makes a difference. So the light at the end of the tunnel would not only come from the documents we read or what you present. We're able to make that assessment given the movement that is there. So I really appreciate what you have just presented. And I must indicate, Chair, that I'm very happy with the way the plans are evolving and they're getting better all the time. But I think there are a few things that I want to raise which might make you even more worried, Advocate Batoi. Now, in terms of those four priorities that you have, which I support all of them, let me take priority number three, which is an issue for me now because it does constitute a risk going forward. It's about capacitating the organization. You have a risk of losing what you're building. And I want you, the first question I want you to give to you as a homework, don't need to respond today. I want to propose before I make this point, Chair, that the NPA must develop an attractive retention strategy. You've got to build that. You need an attractive retention strategy that makes NPA to be a place where people want to be. And let me give you an example why I'm making that point. I am a member of the Magistrate Commission. I'm a commissioner there in the Appointments Committee. We have just concluded the process, which took us about 3 months, where we're interviewing 476 applicants, potential magistrate for the district courts. And out of that, 166 prosecutors and advocates came to us in that interview. We interviewed 166. We're looking for 167 new magistrates. I'm not going to give you the number because there's no announcement yet, but I can tell you more than 30% of that will be coming from you. I'm giving you that bad news, that what you have built in, because when they came through us, we could see stars, the level of performance, and they were ready to be in the bench. And I was conflicted because I'm responsible for NPA, the Magistrate Commission, at the same time in that sector. But there's no way that in that panel I could have let go of a star that is coming from the NPA that wants to be a magistrate. So here is an indication to you, as you put these plans, well, my question is, what are the capacity risks that you would have put in place? And I'm telling you, that's one of those already. In the next month or so, you are going to get something not less than 50 or so. And that is the point is made of how do you build this attractive retention strategy? Because if you don't do that, you will always become a nursery to the other sister institutions. And so that becomes a big threat. And I thought that it's important that you think about that. I am also very much in support, like Velma was saying, on this issue of cable theft. In fact, it's supposed to be correctly defined as economic sabotage. That's what it is. Just goes beyond crime. It's economic sabotage, and therefore the response in terms of how we act on it has got to come close to that. I think, Chair, just as a comment, I also agree with the NDPP that we've got more societal serious work to do. Because when she says conviction on the sexual offences is low, vis-a-vis the reported cases, it says to us the solution is not in the court. It's not in prosecution. The solution is in the mindset, is in how as society we need to deal with these issues. So I want to support that. And being very happy so far, I don't want to go any further, Chair. I thought I must just share and raise this issue of the capacity risk that she's facing and how they urgently need to put up a retention strategy, because you've become a very good school for other institutions. And so if you don't do that, you're only going to be a conduit as they go on into their own further ambitions. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janje. Honorable Ngola.
No, Chair, I'm covered. I'm covered.
Okay. Thank you very much. Just a few things, NDPP and your team. First of all, I must say, no, the APP is well written. And it, I think it gives hope and confidence that things are changing. If we can go back to the asset forfeiture unit, on the target you have set, I think it's about 2.4 billion that you want to recover. I think my question is based on what? What is the assessment of the illicit industry generally in South Africa? And based on the assessment of the illicit industry, how much do you think you want to recover? Because I think between now and 2014, 2.4 billion is too low. But I think it would be important that if it can be based on some scientific study of the industry, what is the illicit industry generally in South Africa? Secondly, you have correctly pointed to the issue of violent crimes and as one of your main priorities. To what an extent are you putting in place a capacity to possibly deal with terrorism, which will be part of the violent crimes? I think it's covered there, but I'm more interested in putting in understanding what capacities are you putting in place to be able to deal with terrorism. You have made mention of organized crime, money laundering, which in some instances are elements of terrorism, because terrorists also use terrorist financing, which is laundered through the banks and through the various means that you have alluded to. But I think you will agree with me that we don't have to wait until South Africa is attacked. Already terrorists are in the north of Mozambique, in Cabo Delgado. So it's important that we must try, as the country, to try and mobilize capacities around our own law enforcement agencies to be able to deal with that eventuality should it happen. But to what an extent is the NPA ready for that? Over to you, NDPP.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for your inputs and questions. I'm going to first hand over to my colleagues online to deal with questions relevant to their particular portfolios and colleagues that are here with me in our boardroom. And then when they are done, I will then deal with questions that may not have been covered. So firstly, I'm going to ask Advocate de Kock, who is joining from Cape Town. I think your colleagues are online as well. If you could deal with questions that fall within the NPS portfolio, please. And I think you have Advocate Pierce Smith as well online for sexual and gender-based violence questions. Advocate de Kock, can we?
Thank you. Thank you very much, NDPP. Good afternoon, Chairperson of the committee and honourable members. Thank you very much once again for the opportunity for us to come and talk about our work. And please guide me. I may have missed some of the questions relevant to myself. On the question regarding life Esidimeni, a decision has been made by the Director of Public Prosecutions, South Gauteng, that this matter be referred to an inquest. The inquest is set to start during June 21 of this year. In relation to the question dealing with the matters of the Fusion Centre, the Fusion Centre is still actively working as we speak. It's a multidisciplinary approach to deal with all matters relating to corruption in relation to the funds that was earmarked to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the Fusion Centre has to report on a monthly basis to the principals of all the relevant law enforcement agencies, including the head of the MPA, the head of the DPCI, the head of the SIU, the head of the FIC, where the Fusion Centre is located. And so there's a strong leadership direction given to the work of the Fusion Centre. Regarding the matters that are currently in the Fusion Centre, there were 288 matters that were looked at in the Fusion Centre. Of that, 71 matters, prosecutors have made decisions where those matters have been investigated. 49 of those matters decisions were made not to proceed with the prosecution, and there are currently 22 cases on our court rolls with a number of accused appearing before the courts. That's in relation to the Fusion Center matters. I'm just going through my notes just to find
There was a question on Advocate de Kock, there was a question on informal mediation and the numbers are going high. Just maybe you can comment on that.
Correct. So the informal mediation has been part and parcel of the work of the prosecution in our courts for a number of years. And it was also in part a response to looking at alternative ways to resolve prosecutions. So it is not always a requirement that all matters that are referred to the criminal justice system must be prosecuted. Sometimes it's in the interest of justice to look at alternative ways of resolving a prosecution. So this is what we call the informal mediations or the alternative dispute resolution mechanisms. And sometimes within communities, that is the best way to deal with a matter, or between parties, that is the best way to deal with matters, where it is not necessary to take up valuable court time in respect of certain cases. So the informal, what we call the informal mediation, is mediation that happens by consent between the complainant and an accused. And of course, the prosecutor is central to how to deal with those cases. There is a policy framework that has been put in place in the prosecution to deal with these matters. And directors of public prosecutions in the various divisions, through their senior public prosecutors, are required to ensure that the policy of the MPA is adhered to and that there is strict compliance with the way in which these matters have been managed. Now, about 2 years ago, the MPA did some research in terms of how these matters are dealt with, just to ensure that we are dealing with it in a consistent and in a uniform way, and what the challenges are with regard to the way in which prosecutors are dealing with these cases. So just recently, we understand through the Department of Justice that the South African Law Commission has been mandated to start looking at this question of mediation in relation to criminal matters. And this is one of the recommendations that we made when we started to look at the informal mediations within the prosecution service, to say that we need a legal framework going forward as to how these matters are going to be dealt with. So the MPA is welcoming the work of the commission. And I just communicated with the commission in the week to say the MPA is prepared to share all the research it has and all its information with the commission. And we are waiting for the commission to call us to a meeting so that we can discuss the matter. But just to make the point in conclusion, that this is an important process for us going forward. As we look at backlogs in our courts, it's not all matters that we want to prosecute, but we must make sure that there's a proper regulatory environment within which this work takes place. But ultimately, we would welcome this legal framework, because then there will be certainty, and it will also provide protection for prosecutors who often are in a difficult position because of the number of cases they have to deal with and the onerous decision-making that we have to make on a day-to-day basis. So Chair, that's just, if I haven't covered the point adequately, then I'm happy to respond further. But that's just to give some context to the work in relation to informal mediations. As far as the question around the Barbarov extradition, I have asked my colleagues online just to follow up with the relevant director of public prosecutions regarding the actual status. With your permission, Chair, if we don't have that information available today, we will be happy to provide a written report to the Commission. And I think it would be better and more safer for us to do it that way than just to give a verbal response in an open platform of this nature. The matter, of course, has been ongoing for some time. There are legal challenges that are being addressed, and I would really prefer that we give a proper written response as to a verbal input at this stage, but I'll be guided by you, Chair. The indicator regarding the cable theft, the reason why that indicator is set at 74%, it's aligned to the conviction rate in our regional courts, which is 74%. But we are doing much better than that. Currently, we are achieving a conviction rate of 88% in relation to cable theft. So it is a matter that we take very, very seriously within the prosecution, and that is why we've now elevated it from the prosecution services annual plan to the MPA annual plan. And then the question that is linked to that in relation to rail safety and the burning of trains is also a very, very important matter for the MPA. And so we have placed those responsibilities in our organized crime components, and we've developed a strategy with law enforcement and the Department of Transport as a response to rail safety, including the question of the burning of trains. So it's a broader response, not just about infrastructure, but also about safety of our communities and safety of the public on the trains. And we have said that the National Department of Transport must take the lead in terms of this response. And so the department has committed also to provide additional security on the rail lines, and also to provide additional security on platforms, etc. But it is a very important issue to law enforcement generally in the country, and a growing concern of the lawlessness that happens on our rail services. And so this is something we certainly need the whole of society to be involved in, so that we can turn around this issue. And it's obvious that it does impact on the success of the economy. Chair.
I think you will agree with us that you can't have a performance of 84%, the real performance, and then you have 74% on the annual performance plan.
Agreed.
That's a target that is so low that you don't have to lift a finger to us.
Yes. So I think that point is well made, and that is something that we will certainly have to take into account. But unfortunately, the way it's written over the NTSF period, and we often are told by our strategy colleagues that sometimes it's difficult to change those numbers, but I agree. And so certainly from a divisional point of view where the work happens, we monitor very carefully when there's a drop in performance. So within the annual plans, we ensure that they keep up with whatever they've achieved before. But we take the point that is something we need to look at so that we can adjust it accordingly to what it should be. There was a question in relation to what are we doing about terrorism. The MPA, through our Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, is very much involved with other law enforcement agencies to respond to the issues around terrorism and to the crisis that we currently are seeing in Mozambique. We're actively involved there. In terms of the building of our capacities, the strategy that we've put in place is to utilize once again our organized crime components within our directors of public prosecutions offices. And so we have put in place special training programs for certain identified prosecutors in those organized crime components, so that when cases arise, we are ready to deal with matters. But at the national level, at the head office level, our colleagues are actively involved in identifying the threats with our intelligence agencies and other law enforcement agencies, and to try and stay on top of issues so that we are able to respond. But I will assure the committee that we are actively involved in dealing with that threat to the country. NDPP, I'm not sure whether there are any other questions. If the colleagues can just alert me. I think there was a question on the community prosection.
Yes, Rani, if you your people can deal, you or your people, it's on the community prosecutions. There was a question on, a couple of questions on the Tutuzela care centers, which I think colleagues can deal with that.
Yes.
And there were questions relating to the tax, tax-related matters. I can deal with the collaborations with SARS, but there were some specific questions relating to that. If, yeah, colleagues can deal with those issues. And then I think that's the NPS part done.
Yes. So our colleague, the Special Director of the Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit, Chairperson, has joined our, she indicated she would be joining, but then there was a challenge with the connectivity. So I'll just check if she is online, if the colleagues can just assist me whether she's joined us now. Otherwise, I would request the Deputy Advocate, Piers Smith, just to respond to the questions regarding the Tutuzela centers, and then also to the question regarding the community prosecutions. So I think Mr. Smith, if you can come in.
Yeah. Advocate Smith, Pierre, are you online?
Good afternoon, colleagues, and Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Good afternoon. Thank you, NDPP and Advocate de Kock. I will deal with the two sets of questions in relation to the Tutuzela Care Centres and also the Community Prosecution Initiative. In relation to the Tutuzela Care Centres, I think it's a well-known fact that it's a one-stop centre to specifically focus on a victim-centred approach in dealing with victims. And just in a short reflection that when we started this process in 2000, at that stage, the conviction rate of those cases stood at 48%. Collectively, with our other stakeholders and with our prosecutors and NPS, we managed to increase that to the current process of where we stood at a 75% conviction rate. But the essence of the Tutuzela Care Center, when we talk about the victim-centered approach, is specifically on how to assist victims that are coming through these centers. And for the past 5 years, I did just a short calculation, we dealt with approximately 160,000 victims that reported matters at 55 sites. Albeit, it must be noted that in the previous financial year, due to the COVID pandemic, it had a negative influence in the number of matters reported, where it was 5,876 or 16.6% less matters reported than the previous financial year, but the quality of services was still delivered. What is also relevant in that regard to note is that with our stakeholders and also because of the emphasis on the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence and Femicide, which was sort of like a run out of the presidential summit, which we had in 2018, we've noted that there was in the past 2 years a considerable increase in more severe sentences being imposed by specifically the regional court in relation to rape matters that went through the TCC centers. To that extent, I can note that that increase was an increase of about 4% in the previous financial years when we look at the number of life imprisonment sentences specifically imposed. Last year, there were 141 of the 779 accused in TCC cases that received life imprisonment sentences. And in the previous year, it was 267. Once again, the reason would be for the slight drop is obviously because of the impact that less cases were finalized due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So that in relation, I think, is a crucial aspect about the TCCs. Honourable members will recall that previously I reported that with the CARDA funding that we received, that we're focusing on 6 sites to be established. Some of them should have been established, 3 actually, by the end of March this year, but also once again, to the unavailability of crucial service providers, we could not proceed with that, but we're targeting 6 sites, which is actually one more than what the business proposal for the CARA funding expected of us, for that to be established within this financial year, in other words, by the end of March 2022. However, out of the six sites, we managed to kickstart or commence our services at two sites. That is the Craddock site in the Eastern Cape and the Paarl site in the Western Cape. I think that will cover the questions in relation to the TCCs, except Honorable Nivo Drachen, our appreciation is extended for your good self to take the time and visit one of our sites. And yes, you raised a very crucial question when you asked, what about the process, as your expectation was that the site services are standardized? Yes, they should be standardized. And we want to focus specifically on the uniformity and equality of service. That's why we currently kickstarted with the new SDPP advocate, Bonnie Karigambu, that was appointed. We kickstarted an efficacy review of all the sites to determine what are the shortfalls and also to determine what the NDPP previously stated. Unfortunately, we were also confronted with staff shortages, which will obviously have an unfortunate negative impact on service delivery. But that is part of the process that we're looking on at to ensure that we have an excellent efficacy review and the implementation of the solutions that we will get out of that to have a standardized process in place. If I'm not mistaken, that covers the question specifically on the TCCs. I will move over to the question that was asked by Honorable Jele in relation to the Community Prosecution Initiative. This is an initiative that has been recently revived, so to speak, by the NPA. And I'm quite pleased to say that in the previous financial year, the expectation of the NPA was to have 22 sites or initiatives identified in the 11 divisions of the DPP offices. All of them identified two sites, equaling hence 22 sites, and nine of these sites are specifically focusing on gender-based violence irritants in the community. As the NDPP correctly reflected, this is the time for the prosecutors where we go out to the community to identify community irritants and what can actually collectively be implemented or addressed to ensure that those irritants are being removed or that there's a better process put in place. So as I indicated, nine of the 22 initiatives are specifically focusing on gender-based violence-related matters or domestic violence as a huge problem in our society, but also it specifically looks also at substance and drug abuse in the communities, but specifically at schools. And honorable members will recall that recently we picked up in the schools the issue specifically in relation to bullying that's a huge crisis at the moment. So we are also going to have a concerted effort from the TCC side, but also from SOCA side and the Community Prosecution Initiative to have public awareness campaigns in the communities, but specifically at schools to address those bullying and to see what we can do collectively to remove that as the irritant in the communities as well. What we also did in addition to the Community Prosecution Initiative is to develop a comprehensive framework or guideline reporting method where we will have a monitoring and evaluation process in place. We've got experienced prosecutors appointed to assist with the rollout and implementation of this initiative, and they are all on SPP, in other words, senior public prosecutor or senior state advocate level, because of the seriousness of this initiative and to ensure that it will be successfully implemented. I think to that extent, that covers the two aspects that falls within my mandate, and I'm done. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. There was one other question before you go. Sorry, Chair. On the DNA backlogs, I don't know if you heard that question, but I know a lot is being done with SAPS. It's predominantly a SAPS issue, which is affecting us really badly, and we have been raising this. If you could just talk to that very quickly.
I will do so, NDPP. Thank you for reminding me. I must just apologize. I missed that question. That is indeed so. The DNA sexual offences backlog is a huge challenge at the moment. That's why the NPA reached out to our colleagues at SAPS, specifically Forensic Science Laboratories. As honourable members will recall, they resort under SAPS, so therefore the DNA forensic analysis report is a huge issue for us because it unfortunately at this stage causes a massive backlog of those cases at court. Now, since we have kickstarted this process, the NPA collated 1,847 cases that are long outstanding on a DNA sexual offences backlog. We have received a number of 482 DNA reports due to our intervention with SAPS and FSL in this regard. And I must say recently, within this week, I received additional analysis reports that were done by the FSL, which is submitted to us at head office so that we can also control strategically the management and the submission of those reports to our colleagues in the DPP divisions. Those additional ones that are received this week will also be distributed to colleagues as well. We are also in the process of developing a specific action plan with SAPS to address it step by step, because what we've picked up also is that unfortunately in some instances, or rather let me put it, in some divisions, there are a low number of these reports that are coming from FSL. Those divisions are KZN Eastern Cape and Western Cape. We've addressed it with our FSL colleagues from SAPS. There will be a concerted effort to focus on those provinces and that division. Mpumalanga was very fortunate because a predominant number of their long outstanding cases where the DNA was requested have been dealt with, or that we received reports in that regard. But and this meeting that I've just spoken about the action plan to be developed, will be on this coming Monday that has been scheduled for 2 o'clock in the afternoon, where we and SAPS will deal with this action plan to collectively have a process in place to address this on an urgent matter. Thank you, NDPP. I think that covers that question as well from my side.
Yes, thank you. Advocate de Kock, is there anything else from the NPS side? If not, we can move over. Yes. Sorry. Please go ahead.
Thank you, NDPP, and thank you, Chairperson, with your permission. The tax, the question on the tax, our understanding of the question was whether we can be using the provisions of the tax legislation to bring criminals to book. And the answer to that question is yes. We, of course, have dedicated tax prosecutors in all our respective DPP offices. Currently, the MPA has 69. Currently, the MPA has a pool of tax prosecutors in all divisions, and we are also building capacity in those divisions that do not have the tax capacity. So, just recently, to give an example of a matter involving one of a very notorious organized crime figure within the province, a particular province. We are now preparing documentation that will use the provisions of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act to prosecute based on investigations that are done through our SARS investigators. So the model that we use is that those dedicated prosecutors only do tax-related matters, and we are refining this to ensure that it's only complex tax-related matters involving fraud and of course, defrauding the receiver of revenue, particularly in VAT-related claims. And then they work very closely with the SARS compliance units and the investigations. And the model that we adopt is that the prosecutors will guide those investigations as well. So, Chair, we are doing a lot of work in this space, and just next week, the NDPP and the Commissioner will be meeting in Cape Town with the colleagues from the prosecution and the SARS investigators to cement our relationship in terms of the work that we do. There's a question. I think we've answered the Barbara question, Chair, with your permission, if we can give a written report on that. And then can I just ask that the Special Director of the Specialized Commercial Crimes Court, with your permission, Chair, gives a brief update on the Steinhoff matter. There was a question in relation to the Steinhoff matter.
Thank you, Advocate Kok. Is Advocate Baloyi on? Yes, I see you. Please go ahead. No, I don't see Advocate Baloyi. Lebo? There you go.
Yeah, at NDPP. Thank you very much, NDPP. Good afternoon to you. Good afternoon, Chair. And good afternoon to all the members. Now, the question relating to the Steinhoff investigation, more particularly that relating to the Steinhoff company paying for the forensic investigations, and this likely leading to a conflict of interest as they are the ones that are paying for their own the investigation against their own company. I wish to point out that although the forensic investigators is being paid for, although Steinhoff is paying for the forensic investigation, I wish to point out that the DPCI are the ones who sourced the forensic investigation. They are the ones who appointed the forensic investigators in this matter, although they were paid for by the Steinhoff. Sorry about that. Now the NPA, although the Steinhoff although the DPCI are the ones who appointed the Steinhoff to pay for the investigations, the NPA supported the appointment by the DPCI of PwC for the following reasons. The PwC had accumulated significant knowledge of the Steinhoff matter over the 2 years they were directly contracted by Steinhoff to investigate the accounting irregularities prior to the initiation of the criminal investigation on the matter, and therefore had in-depth knowledge of the modus operandi applied by the suspects to perpetrate the offenses and of the complicated facts of the investigation. Now, although the format of their report then, prior to the initiation of the criminal investigation, did not primarily focus on criminality and the criminal court processes, they compiled a comprehensive forensic audit report dealing extensively with the accounting irregularities which allegedly took place over a long period of time, to which 2009 until 2017. They were therefore in an ideal position to produce a forensic audit report for the purpose of the criminal investigation and the prosecution within a reasonable time span, notwithstanding what might be perceived as a conflict. Now, the following disadvantages were also considered, should PwC not be appointed as auditors to the forensic investigation of the matter. The forensic investigation of this complex matter would, for all practical purposes, have to start afresh by the new forensic firm. It will also take years for the new forensic firm to obtain all relevant documents and to familiarize itself with the facts of the matter. Now, a colossal number of documents would, inter alia, be the subject of the new forensic investigation. And all those documents were, however, already in possession and under the control of the PwC. It would thus have proved cumbersome to procure all the necessary documents for the newly appointed forensic firm. The investigation proved to be very...
Sorry to interrupt, Debo. I think maybe what you can for the sorry to interrupt, but for the committee, I think it might just be good if you just focus just very quickly on what measures were put in place to manage any perceived conflict of interest. But just highlight those issues.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Thank you very much. Now, with a view to properly managing the perceived conflict of interest in the appointment of PwC as forensic auditors in the investigation of the matter, the following measures were put in place. PwC had to sign a certificate in terms of Section 4 of the Protection of Information Act. This is providing protection against any unlawful disclosures of any confidential information or documentation during the forensic investigation. All the implicated persons have been removed from Steinhoff structures, including the executive and or board positions. PwC's findings will be supported by an independent objective evidence such as bank statements, journals, ledgers, databases, emails, memos, and contractual agreements. PwC also agreed and taking into consideration the consequences of a Section 4 information certificate that no evidence obtained during the criminal investigation would be divulged to Steinhoff, even for the purpose of civil litigation. And in conclusion, it's important to note that in practice, it is neither irregular nor uncommon for a complainant, which is Steinhoff in this instance, to direct a forensic investigation into the company's financial affairs, and that same forensic investigation, the same forensic report is later used with success during the criminal trial. Thank you very much, NDPP.
Thank you, Lebo. Honorable Chair, I believe Advocate Cronier has joined us. There were, I think, three questions relating to the ID. Hermione, are you online? Advocate Cronier?
But does she know the questions?
Yes, they have been communicated to her, Chair. Okay, whilst we're waiting to see if she is online, let's just deal with some of the other questions. Perhaps the AFU questions. I see. I can hear Advocate de Kock saying she, Advocate Cronier saying she's here, but we can't hear her very vaguely, very faint. Hanin, can you put your video on maybe? We can't see you or hear you.
Can we move to the next?
All right,
next
so we'll move to the next. Sorry, Chair. We'll move to the AFU, Advocate Rabaji. Let me just get move. Maybe you can come here. And I'll just turn this.
Am I on? Oh, thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members. There was a question from Honourable Jelly and Honourable Swart on, from the Chairperson on the 1.4 billion target. Why is it low now? Previously, it was 3 billion, and then it was then reduced to 1 billion. Chairperson, this reduction was done during the five-year MTF process. We've had discussion on this matter internally, and we are going to reduce the target back to what it was. We'll just follow the process in terms of how you change targets midway the five-year term. Chairperson, we are really ready for the challenge of bringing back the stolen money, so we are confident that we'll be able to deliver, yes, and to exceed this target. You have seen recently in the media the recovery of 1.4 billion for the Eskom Kusela matter, as well as the 100 million from the Bobref matter. So we will then increase the target back. Then, Chairperson, you asked a question regarding illicit financial flows and the fact that it's got to be scientific. Now, the scientific amount is 4 billion and it comes from a research that is done by the the Financial Intelligence Center. So the Financial Intelligence Center is leading what is called an interagency working group, which has got Reserve Bank, AFU, NPA, prosecution, SARS, and many agencies. Now, all of us are responsible for playing a part in recovering the 4 billion from illicit financial flows. We've prioritized 10 cases, and we meet periodically to assess how we are doing in terms of recovering this money back. So it's not only AFU that's responsible for the entire amount. This is one of the obligations that we report on to FATF, just in terms of the impact and the seriousness in terms whereof, as a country, we take seriously the issue of illicit international flows. Now, also in AFU, we do prioritized matters of this nature. In fact, since I've come in, we've done three matters. We have already forfeited 55 million of cases that were of the nature of illicit international flows, and we're in the process of finalizing 100 million as well in this category. So it's a matter that we take seriously in NPA AFU as well as the interagency working group on international financial flows. Thank you very much.
Hi, Chair, sorry. Oh, is that Hamian?
Yes.
Okay. Chair, sorry, we'll deal with the ID issues. Go ahead, Hamian.
Afternoon, Chair. My apologies. The network in the NPA building in the Western Cape has been down. Chair, because in the interest of time, I'll kick off. The questions as I have it is, firstly, what selection criteria does the ID use in its decision making? Chairperson, the Act requires that, provides for three ways in which matters can be taken cognizance of by the ID. The first is any member of the public can refer a matter to the ID in terms of Section 27 of the NPA Act. What the person needs to do is to, under oath, make an allegation that an offence has been committed and that offence is an offence that falls within the ambit of the ID's proclamation. So the ID's proclamation says that the ID is set up to deal with serious, complex, and high-profile corruption cases, and it sets out a number of corruption-related statutory and common law offences that the ID can take cognizance of. The proclamation also specifically makes reference to the State Capture Commission, the SARS Commission, and the PIC Commissions, and requires the ID to investigate criminal activity identified in the reports from those commissions. So any member of the public can refer a matter, but they have to set out on affidavit reasonable grounds, a reasonable suspicion that a specified offence, which is an offence in terms of the regulation, the proclamation has been committed, and that there is reasonable grounds to believe that offence was committed. So any member of the public, the national director can refer a matter for the ID to investigate, and the ID must then investigate. And the investigating director, myself in this case, ultimately makes a decision about what matters the ID will consider. And Chairperson, one of the biggest, I can go through the selection criteria that we have developed for the ID internally, but ultimately, everyone knows there's no shortage of cases for the ID to take cognizance of, but it's really resources, it's really capacity that dictates what we can take on. By and large, the cases that the ID have taken on, and I've been here before setting out the three broad focus areas that we have divided the cases that we've taken on into. They're the security sector, where we're looking at offences in the higher ranks of SAPS, the NPA, the SSA, crime intelligence, and then the SOEs. We've looked at Transnet and Eskom primarily. I have on my desk request to authorize further investigations in SAA and in PRASA, but you know, until there's capacity to do this work, it makes no sense to authorize investigation. And how we get capacity is determined in the Act by Section 7. We go and knock on doors for investigative resources in other parts of government. We try and relocate prosecutors. We've advertised for 3-year contract prosecutors, and we've just appointed 21 investigators. The 21 investigators started on the 1st of December, but they have to be equipped and they have to have tools of the trade to do their work. They have a building that they need to reside in. So there are a lot of logistical constraints and a lot of capacity constraints that dictate what the ID is working on. So that's why we have focused on doing only cases where we believe we are dealing with those most responsible. So we have not dealt with cases that are low-level officials or junior officials in a government department or junior members of private organizations. We focus at the level of the most senior members of organizations. And obviously those investigations are much more difficult, they're complex, they're hard. I think I can go through the criteria, but I can also forward to the committee a memo that I sent out to all DPPs right in the beginning saying these are the criteria that we will use to take on cases for investigation in the ID, if that will assist.
That will be good, Hamian.
So then if I can move on to the second question, which I understand relates to the migration of the Zondo Commission resources, and it's related to the question of the regulation and what's happening with implementation of the regulation. One of the big issues that I think impact on the migration of the Zondo digital forensic capability is the fact that the commission is still busy doing its work as we speak. We've had a migration plan in place, but twice now we've had to extend the delivery dates on the plan because the commission's work has been extended. There's an in-principle agreement that the capability will be made available to the ID. So the capability consists of three components. There's a hardware infrastructure component that is available to the ID. There's a software component, and the software consists of licenses that have to be renewed on an ongoing basis. And then thirdly, there's the question of the data that is available. And so at the moment, what we have is an arrangement in place in relation to the data. We make a request in terms of our agreed protocol with the commission. We motivate for a particular piece of evidence or, you know, a particular data set. And we say why we are entitled to have sight of that evidence for purposes of a criminal investigation. And the commission makes that available to us. And so that has been happening on an ongoing basis. Where we are challenged right now is the 21 investigators that we employed have not been able to access the software, the tools of the trade, the analytical tools that the commission has, and our prosecutors have not yet been able to use the e-discovery platform that is available to discover our dockets. And so it's something that we're spending today trying to resolve, because there are matters that we are ready to enroll, but we have taken a position that we will only enroll a matter when we are ready to hand over a complete indictment and a complete docket. And we are hamstrung in handing over complete dockets because they consist of vast sets of digital material, cell phone records, email accounts, the bank records. And so today we are meeting with the commission and we've met with the treasury officials who are overseeing this process to ensure that we can place into our dockets this digital material and then be in a position to make the digital material available to all the accused persons when we arrest them. So we've had a number of challenges in smoothing that process over. The aspect around the hardware and the software is that both of those are managed by experts, digital forensics experts. We have got a deviation in place to onboard some of those resources on an ad hoc basis, but our migration and our transition plan needs to make longer term provision for this capability to be available on a more secure basis, a more long-term basis, and on an affordable basis. So our migration plan is in place, but it has had to change a few times. And there's a component of our migration plan that deals with long-term stability and availability and accessibility. I'm very conscious of time.
I mean, there was a question about impact of MLA and extraditions, and particularly there was a mention of the Gupta and extradition. Maybe you want to, I don't know if you can deal with that.
Chairperson, I think there will be an announcement shortly about what we are able to communicate about progress on this front. But obviously, we are dealing with accused persons, and what I can confirm is that they are not yet in South Africa. You know, other than that, our efforts to secure their presence in South Africa are certainly ongoing. We've certainly not relented. We are getting cooperation from a number of countries, a number of counterparts. So really, we certainly haven't given up. And I think that, that's as much as I can say, I think, at the moment. Then there was a... I've got a list of the questions here. The cooperation. I just wanted to answer the question about cooperation with other agencies and the question around SARS powers to restrain and how we work with SARS and the powers that SARS investigators and tax collectors have at their disposal. Chairperson, we collaborate closely with investigators within SARS. SARS have two enforcement arms, a criminal enforcement and a civil enforcement. We have a very close working relationship with the criminal enforcement leg, and the SARS commissioner, I think, when he addressed Parliament, talked about the collaboration and between the two units and the way in which we are targeting suspects, either with tax offences or with other common law and statutory offences that fall within the ID's proclamation. Even in the context of asset recovery, a good example is the seizure that happened of I think 2.4 billion rand held by the Reserve Bank to the credit of one of the original equipment manufacturers in the 1064 contract. SARS was successful in obtaining a preservation order over those funds. We were in communication with SARS throughout, and we were collaborating to the extent that the law allows us to collaborate and share information. In that case, SARS was in a much better position and much sooner able to bring a court application to seize those funds, and we agreed that we will then proceed on that basis. It does not preclude the ID from, at a later stage, and when further funds become available, also going after those funds. And I may as well also address the question of how the criminal economy and what is this 2.5 billion based on, this target for recovery. Chairperson, as someone who worked for the Stolen Assets Recovery Initiative that's attached to the World Bank, there are lots of studies around the value of the criminal economy. And by and large, countries around the world have very effective asset recovery programs and anti-corruption programs rarely ever, if they're looking at that figure, recover more than 1% of that figure. And so we I think have decided not to spend too much time on that figure. What we've looked at is the Financial Intelligence Center, when I started, had done a presentation on what their assessment of the illicit financial flows from state capture has been. I understand the Zondo Commission is going to present similar evidence about exactly what money do we attribute to illicit proceeds from state capture. And we have based our recovery efforts on those financial flows and are, over the 5-year MTF period, looking at recovering a proportion of that figure. But what we've also done is in relation to looking at SOEs and deciding where to prioritize our attention, we took the SOEs where there was the biggest outflow or illicit outflow of funds. So Transnet and Eskom have the biggest budgets of among all SOEs, and they also have had the biggest infrastructure project where looting took place. And we have, in our prioritization, ensured that we stay focused on the most significant ones and that we look at recovering in those spaces. Chairperson, I think I have covered.
I think you've covered all, Hermione. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Hermione. Chair, I'm going to ask Advocate Anton Duplessis to deal with one or two matters that falls under his portfolio. Anton?
Good afternoon, Chair and colleagues, and thank you for the warm welcome earlier. It's really an honor to be part of this team, and thank you also for the constructive and positive feedback. We are truly working hard at the NPA, and as the NDPP said, we are incredibly positive that we're now in good shape to really deliver on the expectations that South Africans rightly have of us, and hopefully this is the beginning of a more positive conversation that we'll be having with the Portfolio Committee moving forward. Chair, I'm going to be very brief and deal just with three quick issues. The first one was just on the numbers that was asked. What are the numbers of prosecutors that we have? At the moment, we stand at 3,550 prosecutors, which is up a total of about just over 700 prosecutors from 1 year ago. And that's largely due to the successful aspirant prosecutors program that the NDPP briefed on. So again, that's 3,550 prosecutors, and we were at 2,833 at the end of the last financial year. The other issue that came up was the question of the Innovation Policy and Support Office. I think Dennis Breitenbach asked that question. Yes, it is very much up and running. It is not something which is necessarily a standalone capacity. It's a cross-cutting capacity within the organization that was originally established in the Office of the National Director. And this capacity infuses innovation and research into all the work that we've been speaking about today. It is aligned to the structures of the organization. We are still in the process of staffing it. It's a small unit, but it basically speaks to the issue of our need to make sure that everything we do is driven by evidence, everything is driven by the latest research, so that we're not necessarily scrambling to come up with solutions without having evidence to drive those solutions. So yes, IPSO is very much a part of the organization. We're hoping to grow it, as I say, and institutionalize it within the organization. And we are basing it on international best practices, where many other leading prosecution authorities have these dedicated research and innovation units. So we're finding it to be as effective as we'd hoped for. And then the final issue just deals with the question of retention of staff. A colleague has rightly pointed out that as one of our priorities over the next 6 months, and this will certainly not end in 6 months, it's about capacitating the organization to deal with the challenges that we face at the moment, but also the challenges we know we're going to face moving forward. And that's particularly linked to the minister's focus on modernization and digitization, but also the changing nature of crime and knowing that we are going to be dealing with a whole range of significantly more complex cyber criminality over the coming years. So what we are doing is there are a range of initiatives, and I won't go into them now, But all of these initiatives are linked into getting the NPA back to being that employer of choice, which young people and dynamic lawyers and others want to be in the organization. And once they get into the organization, of course, it's important that we capacitate them, train them, and develop them so that they want to stay in the organization. And the NDPP mentioned our cultural enhancement initiative, which is also part of this, which is linked to staff morale. And of course, it's been a difficult time with COVID, but we're really excited about the prospects of that for this year and moving forward. And to our colleague about the prosecutors going to the magistracy, I know it's homework for us, so I won't go into detail, but sometimes we are working within a broader system, and it's not necessarily always a bad thing. It is part of the career development prospect. So we will take that into account, but yeah, in general, just to say thank you again to the chair for inviting, for welcoming me, and look forward to the next briefing. Thanks, EDP.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Chair. There's just one or two questions that were not covered. I'll just quickly deal with those. The first one is Advocate Breitenbach and the issue of the LP10. I know this is a matter that the Chair has also raised. I touched on it in my presentation, and I've answered this question that Advocate Breitenbach has asked me at several other engagements with this portfolio committee, and I thought I had explained myself quite well about the difficulty that I find myself in as a national director, potentially, you know, engaging in litigation with her key and very valued staff members, and I've spoken to them. The issue of the LP10 implementation is one that is been, you know, various other NDPPs have dealt with it, and regrettably it was dealt with very badly. And so I've always said my position is not to implement the LP10. We want to implement the LP10 in the manner in which it was envisaged across government. This is not just an NPA issue. It affects legal professionals across government. And so we must implement it in the correct way. So we are planning for implementation of the LP10. And so, you know, we are, it's not like whilst the matter is before the Supreme Court, we are not looking at options and scenarios, because I agree completely. It is an untenable situation that our supervisors and our very valued staff members, and I'm not saying those that are not in LP10 are not valued. They're all very valuable staff members, you know, at LP9, you know, and it's just those that actually created the OSD, I think 15 years ago, didn't realize there was this tsunami that was going to hit us 15 years later and create this terrible imbalance in government. It was really short-sighted. And now here we are sitting with this when it's crashed on shore and we're scrambling around trying to figure out how to deal with it. So it's a very complicated scenario. We are having a meeting next week, the state attorney and Advocate Mohatla from the Legal Affairs Division in my office is leading this process together with the DPSA, Treasury, the DG of Justice to look at, you know, collectively what the solutions are. So, you know, I certainly hope that we are still doing enough to keep our really valued staff motivated. But I was 4 days in office when this matter was before court. And so it was not a very, very, it was really a, what do they say, induction by fire, so to speak, when you are in conflict, so to speak, with your own people. But it's an untenable situation. And I agree, Advocate Breitenbach, even the seniors that are now applying for deputy positions, you can't have a situation where you're going to go into a more senior position, but earning less than you were, in a less, it's a total mess. So bottom line is, Chair, we're working very hard with HR to try to deal with that. The other issue, Chair, very quickly, the Fusion Centre, Advocate de Kock gave an outline of what is happening with regard to the COVID-related corruption cases. I want to say that a lot of good work is happening in the Fusion Centre, but I also want to say that there's, you know, the lack of resources in the SAPs, particularly detectives, is causing some, you know, cases are not moving as fast as we would like. And we had a session in the Fusion Center just, I think it was in February, early March, I'm not sure, to look at what were these risks and how we could deal with those issues in terms of ensuring that the Fusion Center is able to deliver cases with the original intention of speedy prosecution when it comes to COVID-related corruption matters. And Chair, the issue of terrorism that you raised, hugely important. We had a meeting with General Libya, but I want to emphasize, Chair, in as much as we are having a meeting with the SAPs and trying to deal with this, this is a matter of national security. And it's really a matter that I raised at the last JCPS meeting to say this has never been on the JCPS agenda. What is the country's plan to deal with, you know, we can put a group of prosecutors together, we can get a group of investigators, but you need a high-level security plan, probably led by state security. And I understand, and I do believe, not I do believe, there is a task team that was set up some time ago, an interagency task team that hasn't sat for a long time. And I had a chat with Mr. McBride to say to him, you know, this team needs to sit, and I know SSA is looking into it, but it needs to be a government strategy to deal with this very, very serious potential threat that our country is facing. So I want to make that point, Chair. But we stand ready to do what the NPA needs. On SARS collaboration, yes, as Advocate de Kock said, our teams are meeting the SARS investigation capacities, our tax unit prosecutors, the heads are meeting in Cape Town. Commissioner Kieswetter and myself will be there to open the session just to give an indication of the really important, the importance that we put to dealing with tax matters in a more efficient way. And yes, fully cognizant of the Al Capone strategy. We are fully aware of that. Chair, I think that covers all the questions. Quality prosecutions is one that was asked and why that was removed from this from the APP. That's a very good question. That was a very ambitious target that we set. It still sits in the NPS operational plan because we believe that this is a really important indicator of improving our services. So we're collecting a lot of data, and what had happened, this was the first time we had put in this indicator, and part of collection of data meant we needed to be engaging with other partners to get their views on the quality of process, like magistrates, the police, etc. And last year with COVID, it was very difficult to move with this. So we put it in the NPS plan, but we're collecting a lot of data. And I'm glad the portfolio committee has got its eye on this. And so we're going to look at how we could elevate this again. But once we organize ourselves, so we're better able to measure this, which is a really important part of our work. Thank you, Chair. I think that covers everything. If there's anything that we haven't, except for those that we said, we will respond in writing to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any follow-ups? None.
Chair, Honourable Nyehoe-Tuchin.
Honourable Tuchin. Yes. But please be very brief. Honourable Swart.
Yes, Chair, who's first?
Honourable Swart.
Chair, just very briefly on the Steinhoff matter, I just appreciate the explanation. I do understand that there were concerns expressed about possible conflicts of interest, but I think it just indicates to me the severity of the funding constraints. I think it was a figure of 30 million rand that is given by the complainant company. So that's purely from my perspective. I'm not passing judgment or criticizing it. I understand the financial constraints. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Nico.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, perhaps I missed the response. COVID-related expenses so far. Just that one update, follow-up. Not sure, maybe I missed the response. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I'm told by my colleagues that it was 5.1 million. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. To date. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you very much. Thank you for the good APP that you have presented. I think you will take into account the comments we have made to try and relook at some of the issues, especially some of the figures. But I think it's a very good strategy. We are very pleased with the progress that is being made. Honorable Janji raised the point that when you were 9 months old, the committee was very harsh. Now you are 2 years, 2 months. It is
a grown up.
It is less harsh. We can see the way that you are growing up very nicely. But I think it would be also important that both yourselves and the NPA, you need to work very closely on a bill that is going to deal with the independence of the NPA. We are not in favor of policies that are on the pipeline, because we would want to leave a fully independent NPA when we finish our term of office. So it would be good that we can have that bill prioritized. We are aware that we have to deal with some three or four big bills that are long overdue. The NPA, the independence of the NPA would be one of them. We'll still have to work on the to realign the Public Protector Act to be aligned to the Constitution. So we would want, want to appeal to you and the NPA to prioritize that bill, because it's one of the issues that we would want to leave behind, a fully independent and work towards a fully capacitated NPA. Because it's true that within the justice family, we have two entities that can raise money, especially during this difficult economic period for the state. That is the NPA through your asset forfeiture and others, and the SIU. So it would be important that those are fully capacitated, because one of the challenges that prosecutors all over the world are now faced with is that they are fighting criminals that are much more capacitated than them in terms of resources. That is one of the biggest challenges that prosecutors are faced with globally. And those criminals also include terrorists who have a lot of money that is going through the banking system. Now, you would need to have highly capacitated prosecution services to be able to deal with those. I think the issue that was raised by Honorable Janji, that you are seen to be a transitional career as NPA, it could be seen both sides. I think we should also be very proud that you are fitting into the system.
Yes.
Two of the chief justices that we have had are former prosecutors, including the current chief justice.
Yes.
Quite a number of judges are former prosecutors, and quite a number of senior counsel in the private sector. So I think it's a good transition. You will not be able to keep everybody, I think, but you must try, and I'm happy that you are focusing on the wellness program, because I think Honorable Breitenbach would also bear with me that one of the issues that we were grappling with when we're interviewing judges is the high stress in the profession. And it is not reserved only for judges, but even for prosecutors. It's a highly stressed environment. So your focus on the wellness program is quite encouraging, but also it will also need resources. Because you need counseling services, you need quite a number of things to have a proper functioning wellness program that you can say it will alleviate stress and also not force people to leave the profession. Or if they don't leave, they start embarking on other tendencies that are counterproductive. So we are quite pleased generally with what we're seeing, and that also you have almost your top management in terms of your deputy national directors and your special directors. It's quite stable now, and that is highly welcome. But we still think that you might have to move with speed to fill, for instance, the position of the Director of Public Prosecution in the Northwest. We have seen in the last few weeks that there are quite a number of your prosecutors who have been charged for illegal activities. We think that you are going to move with speed to start the processes to discipline them. But we are quite pleased with the progress that you are making. But we will be able to see most of it when we deal with the BRRRs, where you would be now accounting on the performance of the last financial year. We think that your APPs, I think they are fit for purpose. Thank you very much. We don't want to overpromise on what we can do in terms of fighting for resources. It's not an easy fight. It's becoming more difficult every year. But you know that in principle, we do support that. Your budget should not be tampered with, and the growth of your budget should also correspond to the responsibilities that you have. But that is what we will be taking forward as a fight on your behalf. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the committee. Firstly, Chair, we take all your points on board. Your point about the independence of the NPA is crucially important, and I'm pleased that the committee is aligned with our objective of leaving behind a truly independent NPA. So we look forward in further engagements with the committee to present our roadmaps, perhaps, in terms of achieving these objectives. Advocate Duplessis is engaging with the DG of Justice, who, as you know, is the accounting officer. And there's a lot. This is a very complex process, but we're working very hard at trying to ensure that we are able to ensure a truly independent NPA when we are no longer here, and a protected NPA with the right frameworks in place and a very clear understanding of the role of the executive vis-a-vis the NPA. So we look forward. We appreciate that support, Chair. Firstly, I want to thank my team for all the good work that they've done. I don't want to sound like I'm getting an Oscar award yet, but we are still in, as much as we are on the right path, we are fully cognizant of the fact is that we still demand so much more from ourselves. We are on the right track, but we know we have a lot more to deliver before we can say we have achieved what we want to achieve. So there's a lot more pressure that we're putting on ourselves to deliver, because we know how important this is. And finally, I want to thank the committee chair for the oversight and guidance, and we certainly look forward to more constructive engagements. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We will be writing to you soon. You remember we have an outstanding meeting to discuss that issue of prosecutors who have complained from the Eastern Cape in particular. But we want that to be a standalone item so that we can discuss it in full.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I think it was a very long day. Can we meet again on Tuesday? We will try and work through the weekend to ensure that by Tuesday we present the draft revised program. Thank you very much, members.
Thank you,
to everybody on the platform and to those who are watching. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. I was trying to multitask here. I have an assignment due this afternoon.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Chair. Have a good weekend.